Thank you. So good afternoon. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for this program, which is amazing to trigger new ideas and collaborations. Really, thank you a lot. So I will take this opportunity this afternoon to talk in front of an expert audience to present you very recent results that we have achieved with Cyril Eloire, who is there, and Alexia Hofer, who you probably saw during the conference, and which is about trying to derive new witnesses for certifying the presence of entanglement based exclusively on energetic quantities and measurements. So you probably know you all know that entanglement is a key feature for quantum information processing, okay? And so experimentally, when they generate entanglements, then they do some tomography or protocols to in fact reconstruct the density matrix, which can look like this, if, for instance, for this type of Bell states. And in this project, what we did is to consider a specific protocol when we can track back the generation of entanglement as a function of time. So this is achieved, for instance, this was achieved in the lab of Siddiqui's in Berkeley, where you see that the concurrence as a function of time, and the concurrence is a measure for entanglement. So it takes the value 0 for separable states and 1 for maximally entangled states. And you see that as a function of time, they were able to follow the generation of entanglement, and so to certify the presence of entanglement. And here in this project, by considering a specific protocol like this, where we can really follow the generation of entanglement, we took a thermodynamic approach to look at the energetics, which is, if there is some energetic counterpart to this generation of entanglement, and if from this understanding, from this thermodynamic understanding, we can derive new witnesses to certify the presence of entanglement. So that's a bit the goal of the work. Let me start by giving some general overview. So we are here to understand the interplay of thermodynamics and quantum physics. No? So the topics of the interplay between quantum correlations and thermodynamics has attracted lots of interest. And here, let me just give you a few examples. So for instance, one could ask whether quantum correlations can enhance the efficiency of thermal machines. So many people here have worked in this direction. And here, just to give you an example, that you know that the quantum absorption fridge, and it was shown that if the three systems are entangled, so there is, for instance, some bipartite entanglement present there, you can have some advantage cooling. So that's the advantage cooling, and you see that as the entanglement increases, then you have some increase of the advantage, of the cooling advantage. So this is just one example. Otherwise, you could also look at generating entanglement using thermal resources. So these are thermal machines useful for quantum information processing. There have been also many works there. And there have been also other works which are maybe more closely related to the question that I will tackle this afternoon. The first question is whether it's possible to characterize the thermodynamic cost of creating quantum correlations. And for instance, in those works, the people have used a resource theory approach, where they have considered two quantum systems on which can be coupled to a thermal bath, and on which you can apply a general unitary operation. And in fact, they have derived some optimal protocol to minimize the work cost of creating quantum correlations between these two systems. And just as a small remark, the unitary that they have considered as an example is a typical interaction Hamiltonian that people actually use in circuit QED to implement this C phase and C not gate. So it's a sigma z cross sigma z type interaction. And then Janet also, with colleagues, did also some work where they proposed to use energy as a witness to certify entanglement. And this was by considering, for instance, entanglement for thermal states in harmonic lattices or in bosonic gas. if you know other references or I'm interested in, and so please come to me or Cyril at the end. So
it would be fair to mention Vlatko and Czesław Bruckner papers on spin chains. We are among the first doing this for spin chains and solid state systems.
Yeah. Okay. Do they really look at energy? Okay.
Then Hans Bruckner, no, on spin chains.
Okay, so before you work with me. Yeah. Okay. So in our work, in fact, we focused on more on what's happening in quantum information processing. No? So there are mainly two ways to generate entanglement, either by implementing logical two-qubit gates or a measurement-induced entanglement. And this specific measurement-induced entanglement is done via parity measurement. So some of you are really familiar with that, for instance, Andrew. But as people may not be so familiar, I will explain a bit how it works. So, but first, the logical two-qubit gates. So that's how it works. No, this is, for instance, the C-phase gate. So written in the computational basis of two qubits. That's some example of experimental platform where you have the two qubits which are coupled via a resonator, and they can adjust the frequencies of the qubits and the resonator to implement exactly this unitary operation. And this is so kind of measurement that they do to reconstruct the density matrix. Now, in this talk, I will focus on this measurement-induced entanglement protocol, which is a parity measurement or a half parity measurement. So just to so that you have a global picture in mind, so this is, in fact, the operator that I will consider. So if you look at this matrix, it has so three eigenvalues, and two are degenerate. And it's written in the computational basis, meaning that if you measure this this operator, you will distinguish the EE state, so well, in the two-qubit basis, no? So the EE states from the GG states, so two qubits in the excited state or two qubits in the ground state, but you will not distinguish the two odd states, which are so EG and GE. Okay, so that's the action of this parity measurement. And so the idea is as follows, that if you start, for instance, with your two qubits in their ground state, you put them in a maximal superposition state, both. So that's a product state, so qubits are in a separable state. And when you perform this parity measurement, so you will have three possible outcomes. And it's because you don't distinguish between those two states within this odd parity subspace, that in fact you will generate entanglement within this subspace. So it's a lack of knowledge about your state that enables the production of entanglement. This idea so has been realized experimentally in two groups, the one of Leo Di Carlo in Delft and the one of Siddiqui in Berkeley. And so that's the experiment where they have two qubits in two cavities, and then they play with the frequencies of the cavities and the qubits to have exactly this measurement operator. So you see, so this is the output of the cavity, and the blue and the red one are corresponds to the EE state and GG state, so they can distinguish these two states. But the yellow and green curves, which corresponds to the EG and GE states, they are superposed, so they cannot distinguish between them. So maybe let me tell you some history about this parity measurement, because I think it's a really nice way to generate entanglement. So it was first proposed in those papers, and in fact it was shown that it's a deterministic way to generate entanglements, and that's why it has attracted so many interest in the community. Then there were some proposals within solid-state systems in quantum transport setups. either with double quantum dots coupled to a QPC or with double quantum dots coupled to a Mach Zehnder interferometer. Yes?
When you say deterministic, I think. You mean something else, right?
No, it's deterministic because, in fact, what was proposed is a full parity measurement. So in the full parity measurement, the operator is 1, 0, 0, 1. And so either you go to the even subspace or to the odd subspace, but in both subspaces you generate entanglements.
Oh,
so you don't know which base state you generate, but it's a deterministic way to generate entanglement. But here I just show the half parity measurement.
But you still would have to know which outcome you had to be able to use that technique.
Yes, exactly. But you can choose you can also choose in which Bell state you will generate in which subspace, because this depends on your initial state.
But in the end, can you make it? I mean, I thought you always have a heralded scheme where you have, say, the probability is a half, but you know that it has happened because it's been heralded. But I didn't think you could do it completely deterministically and then still use the entanglement. Is that true?
No, it's okay, because what you will measure is just the output corresponding to one of the two eigenvalues. Okay. And so this will tell you in which subspace you are.
Okay.
So, but in this subspace, you can use the entanglement because you don't destroy it. You don't lift the degeneracy between your two states.
So for instance, in the DELFT experiment, they have used feedback to prepare deterministically one of the four base states.
But this was also to avoid some dephasing. And so then there were some proposals also in cavity QED, and then there was the idea of considering this parity measurement, but as a weak continuous measurement. And so that's important because this is what we'll be looking at. And so in fact, instead of doing your projection with this parity operator, you do a weak continuous measurement. And with this weak continuous measurement, you can track the generation of entanglement as a function of time. So this is, for instance, the congruence as a function of time. And you see that, it slightly increases. And then at longer times, it points towards one specific subspace. And so this entanglement genesis was first introduced by Andrew Jordan and his students in 2008. So that's for a brief history. And so, experimentally, what they have is as follows. So they do this this half parity measurement. And so that's the congruence as a function of time. And you see that it increases. And then, they have some losses, dephasings, which makes the congruence decreasing again. To compute this congruence, what do they do is they do some tomography as a function of time. So at some instant of time, they do some specific measurements on their state. And with that, so they reconstruct the density matrix. So for our purpose, what I would like to emphasize is that this parity measurements presents all necessary ingredients to conduct a thermodynamical analysis of entanglement generation. So it's a weak continuous measurement, so we can track back the generation of entanglement. This half parity measurements generates both separable and entangled states. So if I analyze the energetic associated to one type of trajectories or the other type, I will be able maybe to understand the differences between those two trajectories. And finally, so experimentally, they can track a single trajectory. So the question.
Geraldine,
yes.
Maybe I'll make a comment.
Yes.
That this entanglement genesis idea, it was also spurred on by my colleague in Rochester, Drew Eberle, who has something he calls entanglement sudden death, which is the opposite process.
Indeed.
It goes abruptly to zero. So.
Indeed. Thank you. So that's a question that we are asking. No? When entanglement is generated, is there some energetic counterpart of this? And based on this understanding, can we derive new witnesses which are based exclusively on energetic quantities? Do you have questions? So, okay, that's this was for the motivation. So now I will completely show, within this half parity measurement, how we can derive the associated quantum trajectories. Then, given that we have quantum trajectories, we are using the formalism of stochastic thermodynamics that you have heard about during this program. Then I will show you that it's interesting to go beyond average stochastic quantities, namely to look at fluctuations of energetic quantities, and from that, that we can derive some bounds and weaknesses. So that's the model that we are considering. So these are our two qubits, which are weakly and continuously measured. The Hamiltonian of the qubits is very simple. And so from the, in the experiment, you get some measurement record. And the measurement record looks like something like this. So it's completely stochastic as a function of time. Okay. And when you do some analysis that I will show you, what you get, examples of trajectories, just to illustrate, are the following. For instance, so you start from a maximally superposed state, so 0.5. And then either you can go, for instance, to the state GG, or so that's, I plot the populations, no? So that's why it reaches 1. Or you can, for instance, end in an odd superposition. So it depends on your experiment. So how do you get these trajectories analytically? It's as follows. So that's, in fact, the expression of the measurement record. And this is, okay, really simple. So you have some average of your measurement operator. And because it's a stochastic measurement, so you have some Wiener increments to describe the Wiener process. So the Wiener increment is characterized by a zero average over all trajectories and by a variance which is equal to dt. Okay. These are the typical definitions. What's important is that you see that there is this gamma appearing here, and the gamma will characterize the measurement-induced dephasing rate, or if you want, that's the rate at which your apparatus is acquiring information about your system. And experimentally, so that's the measurement record, but they typically average over a certain time window. And this is what I will call the measurement outcome, and this is a quantity that will appear in the equations. Also, let me mention that we start with, it's a specific situation, no? So we start with a pure state, and so in fact the trajectory will be made of a sequence of pure states. So everything is pure here in this work. Because we are in a simple situation where the parity operator commutes with the Hamiltonian of the qubits, then we can easily solve the stochastic Schrödinger equation, and you just get this solution. With that solution, you have to specify your initial state, and previous works have shown that to get maximally entangled state, you have to consider this maximal superposition. And with that, you can so generate the plots I showed you at the beginning. Okay, so that's a bit the formalism behind these quantum trajectories. Okay, so let me give you an example. So that's the measurement record that one can simulate. And from this measurement record, doing this analysis, reconstructing the state, you can compute, for instance, the concurrence as a function of time. And that's the measurement record for two types of trajectories, one ending in the even subspace where there is no entanglement, and one for the odd subspace where there is entanglement. And so you see the concurrence for the odd one increasing to 1 and then being stabilized there. And for the even, it goes to 0 as expected. That's for a single realization. But what's nice in those setups is that you can run several times the experiment. And then you can also perform some averages. So what you can do is, for instance, generate 800 trajectories. And then we do some post-selection. So depending on the final state, if it's entangled or not, so this defines two packets of trajectories, and we average within these two different packets. And so when you average, you get this kind of curve where, so you see that the average congruence for qubits ending in the odd state, and these are for even states, so not entangled. So just to present you the different kind of curves that we can get. So now we can take our thermodynamic approach. So Alexia and Cyril, and maybe now most of you have heard about this stochastic thermodynamics approach, so I won't be too long there. But so given a single trajectory, you can define so the internal energy of your system, which will be just the average of your system Hamiltonian with respect to the quantum state along for a given trajectory. Given our initial state, our initial energy is zero, and so we can define a change of internal energy along a single trajectory. In our setup, there is no work on because our Hamiltonian for the qubits is time independent. Okay, so this is why we can associate the change of internal energy to heat exchange only. So that's a specificity of this setup. Given that, you can so generate many trajectories, and you can do this post-selection average that I introduced before. And this is what you get for the two types of trajectories. So all along the talk, entangled trajectories will be red, and disentangled will be blue. Okay. So what you see is that when you generate entanglement here, there is no heat on average along trajectories. Whereas when you generate so product states, either EE or GG, there is some heat that is generated. And in fact, you can associate this heat to dephasing processes that that enter your measurement process. What is nice also to see that at long times, that's quite important, so your trajectory, your output, sorry, your measurement outcome will be one of the three eigenvalues of your operator, no? Either 1, 0, or minus 1. And so the energy you see is just so epsilon, so the energy of your qubit, times the eigenvalue. So either 1, 0, or minus 1. So to make the connection.
So, Geraldine, yes? This is a post-selected average. So the noise we see in the curve, it's not smooth, it's due to the finite time of your simulation,
or is it not smooth? Yeah, I think it's because of the finite time interval that you over which you discretize your time interval, and maybe over and the number of trajectories. But yeah.
Okay, so it's statistical.
Yeah, it's statistical noise. Yeah.
So. This initial state that you take, so you mentioned that you don't consider any work and you consider all energy to be heat, but the initial state is sort of funny, right? I mean, I'd imagine I have to generate that superposition by the application of a Hadamard, and that would cost work, right?
Exactly. So, in fact, the energy that one has to consider there is the energy needed to create this initial superposition. Then once you have this superposition, everything can be considered as heat exchange to the stochastic measurement. But indeed, if you want to look at the thermodynamical cost of this, you have to take into account the work to prepare this state. But here, I'm not looking at the thermodynamical cost. So that's
a point. Could you please repeat this connection to defacing? Defacing it?
Okay. When you do the analysis of parity measurement, then you realize that the two odd states, they will overlap exactly thanks to symmetry adjustments in your settings. And because they overlap exactly, they will be affected exactly in the same way by your measurement process, so there will be no measurement-induced dephasing between these two states. But for the even states, in fact, it's different, because also the observable is the same. The states do not overlap completely. So in fact, there is a phase difference between them. And this phase difference will induce some dephasing due to the measurements. And so there will be some dephasing, and you can link so the amount of dephasing to this, well, the dephasing process to this heat which is generated.
Okay. Maybe now if we trace out the other qubit also, there is a, so the, all this is a single dephasing channel for one qubit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the outcome, I mean, on average, this can be also seen from the point of view of a single of the qubits, only one of the qubits, as a regular diffusion channel.
Yes. I think so. So you say when you do the measurement, but then you trace out one qubit, and you look at so. Yeah, I think there will be. Yes. But why are you asking this, or what do you...
Well, I'm wondering why you call that dephasing channel. Or each of the qubits is perfectly fine.
I think she does the post-selection, is the question. So when you do the post-selection, you can distinguish between
the different types of trajectories. But this I think you don't need to add in extra dephasing channels, because it's, if you want to take into account additional dephasing of each qubit, you add those channels, as it is done in the experimental papers. But if you don't look at extra dephasing, it's only your measurement that is inducing some dephasing. But this measurement-induced dephasing is not present in the odd subspace.
Yes, but what you say is that there's a 2D manifold for the two qubits, which is preserved
yes.
by the channel.
Yes.
So the dephasing.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So then, okay, these are the references to this stochastic thermodynamics. And so, what we want to do is to compare energetic quantities to the generation of entanglement. And so you see that when entanglement is generated, so we have no heat on average along a single trajectory, whereas when we go to separable states, we have some heat generated. So one can think that, okay, that's a way to know if there is entanglement in your system. You can measure heat along the trajectory. If there is no heat, you know that your qubits are in an entangled state, and if there is some, so then, okay, you guess they are in a separable state. But to our opinion, it's not a conclusive argument, because here, so experimentally, as Benjamin said, you typically have additional dephasing channels, no? So on average, you will also have some heat here generated. So then you cannot know if it's entangled or separable states. Yes?
Yeah, you are saying heat generated, but if I take into account the signs, I would say that in one case it is released and in the other case it is absorbed.
So it's heat exchange.
Okay.
Yes, it's heat exchange. So, so that's why, okay, from this, if you want, from this observation, you can extract information about your measurement, if it's QND or not, if there are some dephasing from the heat along a single trajectory. But it's hard to make some conclusive remarks when you look really at genuine quantum feature like entanglement. Yes?
But from a single trajectory, will you be able to see if it is zero or positive?
So, okay, that's an experimental issue. And, it's also with that respect that I think it's nice to present that here, because there are many experimentalists. I think it's challenging, no? Because you have to keep track the heat along a single trajectory. But we have seen some experimental talks where they are really, now they can measure the heat currents, you can track back, so I guess that's a strong motivation to go towards that direction.
Yeah, but I don't mean to measure the heat, but to distinguish if it will be zero average or positive average?
Well, I think that's possible, no? Because if you do many runs of the experiments, now they know very well, they have a very fine tuning and they can distinguish very well different types of averages. So I think this would not be an issue experimentally.
Just to make a comment, in this trajectory, they can distinguish whether or not it's gone into the E subspace, the GG, or this entangled subspace. And so,
yeah, but trajectory allows you to determine the trajectory ends in one.
Every trajectory has an average.
It ends in one of the three. It points towards one of the three eigenvalues. So at long time, it's always either 1, 0, or minus 1. You cannot have another thing.
But I have a question, Geraldine. Yes. So is this an observation specific to this entanglement generation protocol that entangles of space corresponds to no heat exchange and the separable subspace is heat exchange, or do you think that's generally true, or true with other types of measurement to reduce entanglement?
Well, I think, so that's not the perspective, no, or another project, because of course the results we have derived are model dependent, we're considering this very specific measurement process. With respect to heat, as I said before, typically you will have additional dephasing channels. So I think you will not, it's not conclusive. You will typically have heat here. And so it's not, you cannot draw a conclusion from that.
I guess I don't understand why. How extra dephasing channels really necessarily correspond to heat. Because associate dephasing with heat? Because dephasing in this case would just sort of mix up what entangled state you're in, but it wouldn't necessarily change what subspace that put it into E or GE, those are the measurements.
Yes. I have not a definite answer.
But I guess in your change in energy is pushed back, the dephasing time, E to the gamma T, to show up in the equation, so I guess.
Sorry?
I guess just looking at this equation, that dephasing rate plays a role in the exchange tube.
Yes, so here everything is related, no? Because it's a very specific setup. So I don't know if for all the protocols it will be the same, but what I will show you when you look at fluctuations is that you can have much more conclusive behavior, and I think this might be generalizable to other protocols. So we wanted to go so beyond this average heat exchange or average stochastic quantities. So now let me introduce this novel quantity that we looked at. So you can either look at the heat which is exchanged along the whole trajectory, okay, that we call Q gamma. But you can also look at what happens during each time interval dt, a smaller time interval dt. So you divide your time row in small time interval dt, and you can look at the infinitesimal heat exchange increment during this time interval dt. And this is what we call this delta Q gamma. Okay? This delta Q gamma, when you integrate it from zero to time, you recover the heat exchange along the whole trajectory. It is defined as the infinitesimal change in your internal energy. And so from this quantity, you can look at the standard deviation of the fluctuations that we define like this. And so here we do some average, and maybe let me just explain you what this average means. Do you all see if I draw here? Well, it's just a small drawing, but so this is time, and so here you have your trajectories, and so you define your time in small time intervals, so dt. And what I want to look is are the fluctuations over this time interval dt. So I fixed my time t, And then from this time, in fact, I can also have several trajectories. I have several possible trajectories. So what this average means is that I fix the initial time t, and then I average over all trajectories that take place between t and t plus dt. So it's a way to average when you look at the infinitesimal increment.
All trajectories that are at that location?
Yes. Yeah. So you fix, you see, you fix I gamma, so you fix one trajectory.
Okay.
You fix the initial time, and then you look during the time interval dt at all trajectories, and you can average over those. So this is the definition, and now, okay, to compare, to make some qualitative study with respect to concurrence, let me introduce you a new type of plot. Okay, so this is the one I showed you before, where it's a concurrence as a function of time.
But sorry, I was trying to understand this. Do you take the derivative?
So that's the infinitesimal change in the internal energy.
Yes.
So, I have it at the end. I can show you. So, you see, it's an infinitesimal change in internal energy, which is defined like this.
Yeah.
So then, using Itô stochastic calculus rules, then you can, so you write this as the derivative of, well, this state plus the derivative of this state and this term. And here you expand up to the first order in dt. And this is how we compute it. And we plug in exactly the trajectories, the states that I showed you before. Yeah, so this is a plot that I showed you before, and now I will introduce a new one, but which contains exactly the same information. So this is a concurrence, again, but it's a density plot, as a function of time here, and as a function of the measurement outcome. So let me explain it to you by looking first at long time. So long time is here, the eigenvalues of my operator are minus 1, 0, and 1. And so you see that at long times, my concurrence can only take 3 values, 0, 1, or 0, depending on the measurement outcome. Okay? At smaller times, the trajectory is not yet well defined. No, you don't know in which subspace it will end. So then that's why the concurrence, you have some finite concurrence here. And if you take this red curve, correspond exactly to this cut as a function of time. You see that concurrence starts from 0 and then increases up to 1 and stays to 1. Whereas here, concurrence so start from 0. There is some finite concurrence. That's a little blue peak. And then it decreases to 0. So that's the plot, and then we can, that's just a control plot of the concurrence showing when concurrence changes from 0 to 1. So now let me show you the plot that we get for this standard deviation of this infinitesimal heat exchange. This is what we get. So you see that if I show again, so the 3 eigenvalues of my operator. So I have, at long times, I have no fluctuations. Blue is 0. Okay, I have no fluctuations at long times. But whenever I have a change in the concurrence, which was shown by this contour plot, you see that this change of concurrence exactly fits when I have fluctuations in this infinitesimal heat exchange. Do you have questions on this plot? Yes?
If you have some other kind of weights on the on your superposition that would mean that you would shift to the right or to the left in this problem?
No, if you have, well, okay, let me think. If you have different weights, then your probability distribution for your outcomes will be. The probability for your outcomes, the probability distribution will be the same. It's just the probability to get an entangled state or a separable state which will be different, but it will not be shifted. So this is like a qualitative analysis, okay? But then because we have all analytical expressions of the states and of these standard deviations, there is this energetic hallmark that it seems to be the case that when the concurrence is changing, so when the derivative is non-zero, then you have some fluctuations of energy exchange. So now, so because we have all the expressions analytically, we can work a bit more in a quantitative way. So what we did is that we express this change in the concurrence by its derivative. We get some expressions. That's not so right now it's not so important. And we can also write the exact expression for this standard deviation, for these fluctuations of heat exchange. And you see that, it's quite similar, the first terms. And here the second term depends on your heat exchange and on the concurrence and on the average value of your measurement operator. Considering that the concurrence takes values between 0 and 1, in fact, you can work out these expressions to define a lower and upper bound for the derivative of the concurrence. And what is nice is that you see that the upper bound only depends on these energetic fluctuations, and the lower bound depends also on these fluctuations and on the heat exchange along the trajectory. So what does it mean if I take an example of trajectories? So here is an example of trajectory ending into the even subspace and into the odd subspace. What is plotted in blue and red is a concurrence for each kind of trajectories. So that's the derivative, so it's the derivative of the concurrence for an even trajectory, and that's for an odd trajectory. And in black, what you see are the lower bound and upper bounds. And you see that, in fact, it works quite well. It works well at the level of a single trajectory. Okay, so we could really bound the change in entanglement genesis thanks to energetic quantities. Yes?
So if I understand, you're implying that this sigma is something that you can measure in the experiment.
I hope so, yes.
So I didn't understand well the definition, because these trajectories that start at the given time.
Yes. So, analytically and theoretically, it was a proper way to look at these fluctuations. But as I will show you later, I think that indeed experimentally it might not be trivial to do this average, and more or less to do this average, you need to know the measurement outcome. So it's not fully energetic, no, because you still need the information about your trajectory. So that, as I will show you, we have derived a witness which is very similar, but which does not depend exactly on this sigma gamma, but which only relies on a single trajectory without averaging of results. So. But that's a complete remark.
Geraldine, what are your error bars mean here?
Okay, so good question. Everything is stochastic here. Okay, so the derivative of the concurrence is also stochastic. But to see something on the plot, we have averaged this stochastic derivative over a finite time interval, which is 0.4 gamma. And this is... So the points are the averages, and the overall balls correspond to this average.
The
fluctuations in the average?
Yeah. Over this small time interval. But for the bounds, we have not performed any averages. But otherwise, it was too much fluctuating, and I think the information was not so clear.
Another quick point is that because you have these, for example, when it goes up from zero to something finite, the derivative is not defined at that point. So I guess other places where it jumps in a sporadic way, you wouldn't have a well-defined derivative. And so how do you handle that? If I just have a Wiener process, yeah. It's a continuous function, but the derivative doesn't make any sense.
Okay, that's why formally we do this average, because then, in fact, we can get rid of the Wiener increment, and we just get some dt, it averages to zero, and this derivative only depends on g gamma, which is a measurement outcome, which is continuous. So, yeah, that's how we do. So, then, okay, you can think that if you want...
Yes? I can ask you something. But this, the points for the trajectory are the average or the most probable trajectory?
Okay.
So is the mode or is the average?
No, okay, that's for a single trajectory.
Yeah, but then you have an average, right?
Yes, but this average is the one I discussed there, and it's still along a single trajectory. Okay. You fix one given trajectory.
I see.
And for a small time interval dt, you look at the fluctuations of your measurements there, if you want. But it's within a given trajectory.
Okay.
So that's important because all this is done at the level of a single trajectory. So you don't, at the end, you will not have to average over several runs of the experiment to say if your trajectory was leading to an entangled state or a separable state. And so then naively you can think that, okay, in my system, I will end up with qubits in an entangled state if at all times t, I have a positive derivative of the concurrence, positive or equal to zero. So then from the lower bound, we can so derive this condition to get entanglement at the end of our process. And so with this, in fact, this allows us to derive some weakness. So here, okay, to make it simple, this is the weakness that does not require so the average I was talking about. So this is really an exclusive energetic weakness along a single trajectory. And so let me explain you this plot. So the idea of a weakness is that if it's positive, then you don't get entanglement, but if it's negative, then you get entanglement. We wanted to have a time-independent weakness, so this is why we do this integral over time, that over some time interval that I will explain. With respect to the condition of having the weakness taking positive or negative value, so let me show you these two plots.
Normally, a weakness is the first equation is reversed. No entanglement means W positive.
Yes, that's what
normally, I'm saying in quantum information, I'm not saying your case.
But
traditionally, you would say a separable state will have a positive expectation value of an operator.
Yes.
Therefore, if you find a negative value,
yes,
you would exclude separable states.
Yes. But that's the idea here.
It's not necessary. It's the other way around. It should say no entanglement, W bigger than zero.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Unless unless it's really two, which would be nice.
It would be nice.
I think in our... I think it's true in this case, but...
Oh, no, it's good.
But,
say it's an equivalence because there is a big loophole that the whole model is in assume, right?
I guess so. So, but okay, I don't know. Here, I think, yes, within this model, that's true.
It's also a good case for IRL.
But yes.
For 2 qubits, it can be back and forth.
For 2 qubits, it's always equal.
No, it depends. But you can find cases where it's both ways, for 2 qubits.
And also, I don't know, but it's not an observable, but it's something
with
the
event
in the past,
yeah. So
maybe the
terms are not the same. So it's a quantum info inspired witness, no? But in fact, maybe it would be wiser to call it some indicator or estimator, I don't know, but it's just... So, okay, let me now introduce this time integral. So we fix some initial time and final time over which these energetic quantities will be averaged. Okay. The plots that I am showing you is as a function of the initial time, and so the two colors they correspond to two different final times. So to make it simple, first let us look at when the final time is 10. So you see 10, it's a long time on the time scale of the experiment, so then you know exactly where your trajectory, well, what's the state of your qubit if you do the measurement at that time. And okay, so this is the light green, so it's for TF is equal to 10. And there you see that my witness, so that's the concurrence, so it disappeared, the C. But you see that, so when the concurrence is 1, for almost all trajectories, the witness is negative. And in fact, so here it has been, it's just a zoom, if you want, on the y-axis. But when the concurrence is 0, then you have positive values for your witness. And if you want to see if your witness is reliable or not, you have to look at the success rate and the error rate. So the error rate is when your witness will tell you that you have an entangled state, whereas it was not entangled. When we look at the error rate, it's zero, in fact.
Sorry. Could you say again the two left figures? What is the difference between?
So the difference is, it's a bit tricky, but it's just the points that we get when we consider different final time.
Oh, I see.
But, okay, maybe I should just say that if you want to do some single shot measurement of this witness for your trajectory, in fact, it's better to do it at longer times, because then your trajectory is almost, is really towards a given subspace. And you can do a very short, you can measure over a very short interval, and this will give you a success rate which is really high. Okay, so that's the message of this plot.
Geraldine, could you walk me through the units of your formula? I'm a little bit confused about what is, so Q is energy average, right?
Yes.
And epsilon is also the energy difference of the qubit.
Yes, exactly, that's the energy gap.
And delta Q is just a difference of energy.
Yeah.
Right, so it looks like they have different dimensions.
No, here there are some missing...
everything should be divided by epsilon square. Everything should be divided by epsilon square.
Yes, there is some missing energy there.
Okay.
It's the energy of the qubits.
Okay, all right.
Yes.
So even if you had it, so let's say the dimension of the left thing is correct, then that's dimensionless, right? Mm-hmm. Then the whole thing has units of time, correct?
Yeah.
So when you say 10 to the minus 6, what are the units on the y-axis here?
Well, good question. Like,
doesn't have units. Time doesn't have units as well.
No, it's 1 over gamma.
Well, on the x-axis, it's 1 over gamma. Is it also 1 over gamma on the y-axis, or is it or not?
Time is always in units of 1 over gamma. So, Okay. What I don't know is that here they, I mean, for this quantity, they also depend on gamma and dt.
The TF is expressed as a function of 1 over gamma of x.
Yes.
6 divided by gamma.
Yes.
So indeed, yes, the unit is 1 over gamma for the y-axis of the volume.
Of the volume, yes, okay.
Okay, so W is measured in units of time.
Yes.
Maybe we will take around to divide by the time interval just to get
To get some average, yes. Yeah.
This won't change the sign.
So, okay, maybe that's the main message, that by doing this energetic analysis of entanglement generation with this specific protocol, in fact, we can associate a clear indicator of the presence of entanglement thanks to these fluctuations. Well, it's a ratio between fluctuations and heat exchange which matters.
Excuse me, I have to take a spider down. Never mind.
They want to be smoking.
Okay, so then these are my conclusions. So I showed you that, okay, thanks to this parity measurement, which in fact allows you to really follow the generation of entanglement, and thanks to the experimental facilities that are available, we could so do the stochastic thermodynamics of this specific protocol, show that, okay, when you look at the heat exchange along a trajectory, that, okay, the fact there is no heat is a signature, but it's not really something that increases with the increase of entanglement. Whereas if you look at these fluctuations, you really see that they are present whenever you have a change in the concurrence. And so from this theoretical analysis, we could define some weakness. And with that, maybe I would like, respect to especially the experimental talk that we heard, that maybe if, okay, one first thing would be to try to see if one can measure these fluctuations, these energetic fluctuations, and see if, okay, we can so measure or have access to this indicator or witness. And as perspective, well, one can also look at what's happening with the entropy. And for instance, if it's only model-dependent results, or if it can be generalized. But I think this is, well, to our knowledge, that's maybe one of the first work which really establishes a clear connection between quantum correlations that are generated and some energetic quantities. So thank you for your attention.
So I guess I have so this can you maybe you can show again the weakness on the ground.
Yes.
So essentially maybe I have an issue in the fact that in the former slide where you have this.
So what, sir?
In the former slide where you have the equality. So on the left you're comparing. Well, you say the energetics here, but this cannot. This is not something that can be measured by a power meter or of any sort, right? This is the quantum heat,
yes,
as it is called, which is calculated from the quantum state we know the system is in.
Yes.
And in the middle too, the concurrence can be obtained by looking again at the quantum state of the pair of qubits.
Yes.
So in this inequality, what traversing is that we seem to compare mathematical quantities that are connected to the same measured object, which is the
state.
Quantum state of the qubit.
Yes.
So I wonder how an experiment could bring in would an experiment really test this inequality better than a simulation would do?
Maybe not, but so the point of these bounds is that it shows you that, okay, the confluence depends on your quantum state, as you said. And in fact, by doing this analysis, we could show that we can derive so bounds which do not depend on the measurement outcome G gamma. So if you are able to measure the heat exchange along a trajectory, but without having your measurement output, without having J gamma, you couldn't be able to certify the presence of entanglement.
But you could not measure this heat using any apparatus we know. This is not an actual heat that is exchanged, right? It is the revealed work that was provided by the two Hadamard gates at the end of the experiment.
For me that's something that is not clear is why are you sure that you could not measure this heat? Because for me it's not clear that you have put work at the beginning to generate your superposition, but then there is some heat exchange, no? So, and that's really heat because it's due to a stochastic process, which is your measurement.
In the device you show, there is no energy exchange between the probe and the system at any point. This heat Q gamma is only arising from the variation of the work, the quantum fluctuation of the work that was provided at the beginning to create the superposition state. So maybe we could measure indeed this the pulse that was used to generate the superposed state and reveal whether or not it's it has lost a photon or two or zero. This may be done, but it will not be some key that will be measured. You see, on the probe or on the system at any level.
Hello.
You don't have to access the probe at all.
Yes, you don't need to access the probe. So you're saying essentially, so we could access the pulse that generated the initial superposition?
Here's a question, so it's puzzling. That pulse that is used to generate this initial superposition state gets detected by something, it's absorbed by an attenuator. So it's detected, yet the fact that it's absorbed and detected by something doesn't have any bearing on the purity of the angle states that are generated.
Yeah.
So this means there's no energetic signature that can be detected in that pulse. So maybe the question is whether or not it is that initial pulse that work is being revealed, because it's being detected somewhere and doesn't have any effect.
Or maybe
it does have
an effect. And the signal projection.
Fortunately, it is requiring the same initial state.
Yes. Well, you could change the initial state, but then you will end up in a different Maximilian tangle state. But it does not change the physics.
But if you look at the state of the pulse that prepares the qubit states conditioned to the ultraviolet gates, you will have a different state for the entanglement.
So, Geraldine, I'm interested in your Bacchus formula, that if you throw away the Q on the right-hand side there, that the two bounds, I would hope that they would coincide, and they almost coincide up to a factor of two.
Yes.
Can you comment on this?
From the analytic formula, you can, if you want this, in your parity measurement, yes, you will distinguish between these two subspaces. And you can associate, so the total heat fluctuations, sigma gamma, to the whole process, but you can also separate this part into fluctuations which are within the even subspace and between the even and odd subspaces, in fact. So there are two contributions. And this factor two, in fact, shows that here, if you want, in the upper bound, these two contributions appear, whereas in the lower bound, at long times, it's only the fluctuations between even and odd. So, well, that's what's behind this factor two.
I missed one thing. So here you're saying that, okay, if the derivative is positive or non-negative, then it means that the other thing you have
has something. But this is what you would like, no? If it's positive at all times, because of the bounds, then this would mean that this would be positive at all times.
What I don't get is that, so the quantity on the left could be negative, but the state would be still be entangled for some time.
So yeah, exactly, because it's fluctuating, no? So it could be at some point negative, but then increases again, but at the end you still end up in an entangled state. But if you do the average over the trajectory, you want it to be positive or equal to zero.
But you're assuming that the concurrence either always increases or always decreases. You're always assuming that, so this quantity on average is not changing sign. In principle, you can have a process where the concurrence oscillates.
Yeah, but okay, we see that, no, in these curves, that the derivative oscillates. So, and sometimes it increases, sometimes it decreases.
Okay.
But still, if you want
what I don't understand is why are you not connecting the concurrence instead of the derivative of the concurrence?
Because for the concurrence, there is no clear link. In fact, there is no clear link with these fluctuations. And I think it's really... I think that's the density plot where you see that, okay, as long as you have a finite value for the concurrence, then you have no fluctuations, and you will have your average heat. And you can look at this, okay, that's fine. But I think what's interesting, and what we would like to emphasize, that when there is a change in the concurrence, so if when your off-diagonal terms in the density matrix are changing to build up non-local correlations between your two qubits, in fact, this is associated to heat fluctuations. And that's why it's interesting to really relate the change in concurrence and the fluctuations.
But it's more, sorry that I'm reiterating this. I think you're relating the rate of change of entanglement, not the entanglement itself.
It's the rate of change.
It could be entangled, but its derivative could be negative. The derivative of the concurrence could be negative, but the state will still be entangled.
No, but if it's positive at all times, then you show that it will be, that you will get some entangled state.
Of the concurrence. You have another process with another Hamiltonian, where on average the concurrence oscillates sinusoidally, and there is a moment where the derivative is negative, but the state is still entangled.
Yeah, okay, but that's within this model, no? I don't say that this is always true, but within this parity measurement, because you know that you will end up in one of the three eigenvalues, this is fine.
So what changes if you have a full parity measurement, not a half parity measurement?
Well, a full parity measurement. Okay, from my knowledge about the full parity measurement, if I look at the average heat along trajectories, so like this curve, I will still get some heat in the even subspace because I have some additional dephasing due to the process.
Why? No, because you go down to EE plus GG.
Yeah, but there is measurement-induced dephasing within that subspace, which I guess, well, from my belief is that it will generate some heat.
But
smaller than that, but still.
But at the end, it should just be E plus GG, and the expectation of the Hamiltonian that is just your zero, right?
Yes, okay, you're right. At long times, it will be zero, but I get on average. Well, I expect that some. Okay, maybe then it's non-monotonic, but I don't. Okay, for heat, I don't know.
My prediction is going to be exactly the red dash line. But that's a homework assignment.
Yes. And then for the fluctuation, so in a full parity measurement, you generate And then in both subspaces, so I guess your lower bound will be also something like this in the even subspace. Yes. But here, okay, the idea, the motivation to look at the half parity measurement was really to compare separable trajectories that lead to separable state and to entangled states. Because if we would have considered full parity measurement, we would not have been able to draw conclusions about signatures of entanglement.
Any more questions?
I guess I have one more question. So you consider a pure initial state here.
Yes.
And I imagine if you had a thermal initial state, some low temperature, some impurity, mixed state, it would just reduce the purity of your entangled states in the end and maybe shift your threshold. I wonder what effect it would have in within that would be the same in a full parity measurement, or in that case, you're less susceptible to impure initial states. What if you added temperature to this?
So, okay, with temperatures, we have additional dephasing, and that's something we want to look at, so how these bounds behave with dephasing. But what you were saying is that if you start with thermal states, well, to have this protocol working, you need some coherences within each qubit at the beginning. So you can, if you start with thermal states and apply this parity measurement, it won't work. So you may have some temperature, but not too much.
Okay. Thank you, Geraldine.
Thank you.